Lives of the Mind explores the passions and pursuits of quad citizens who live their lives by their interests through meaningful conversations that cultivate curiosity, encourage lifelong learning. Hello, I'm Maria Wood, and I'm here today with Charles Navarra, and joining me in the WVIK studio today is Dr. Brian Leach, who is a professor of history at Augustana College. So, Dr. Leach, how did you end up coming to Augustana?
That's a great question. I came to Augustana a little over a decade ago. I actually came here to teach part-time because my wife was going to go to chiropractic school across the river, and they have never gotten rid of me, so, despite, I'm sure, efforts. But
now, at Augustana, you teach history, and in talking about yourself, you mentioned that more specifically you like to focus on mining history. But what brought you to studying mining history and sort of that social, environmental form of history?
Well, I guess that maybe should start with environmental history. I became really interested in people's relationship to the natural world. When I was an undergraduate, I had some professors who did a number of different kinds of approaches to the environment that came from the humanities or came from the social sciences, which I'd never experienced or encountered before. And history seemed like a great way to better understand why it is that we use specific natural resources, and then essentially how and why we now put them in things like the graphite in our pencils, or why these kinds of objects actually have some meaning to us and where they come from, right? Why is it that we combine certain kinds of things together? So actually, I came into mining history kind of from that angle. And so if you want the real truth to why I'm interested in mining and mining history, though, it's because I grew up in Montana and I drove by a lot of mines or went into them. I had school field trips when I was in grade school at mining facilities where they would go and show you the reclamation efforts they were doing. And so I was always kind of interested in mining and knew too little about it. And so my real interest in mining just came from kind of a local knowledge of knowing that it happened, but not really why or how it affected people or the environment.
So along with doing environmental history, it has a lot to do with like the natural world, along with like how we work with it, use it. Do you find yourself working with other disciplines like geology, environmental studies, things like that?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the best things about this weird little sub-discipline called environmental history is that you kind of have to talk to different people. You have to read different kinds of things. So I had to sit there and try and interpret, engineering documents, which I had no idea how to read when I first started getting interested in mining engineering and mining history. And then eventually realized that even many current modern day engineers had no idea what was in those documents because they do engineering so differently now. And then I had to figure out what actually the impacts were on the environment beyond just what people were describing in interviews or in their own documents. And so, yeah, so then I ended up having to talk to environmental scientists and read some of the things that they were writing too. So I think sometimes when you just find a particular subject, you end up having to kind of reach out into different areas that you weren't expecting.
So this sort of area of research has led you to write a lot of articles about mining and a lot of award-winning articles about mining, and more specifically, Butte, Montana. Is that close to where you grew up?
Yeah, Butte, Montana is about, an hour plus away from where I grew up. And yes, so I think my real interest is from Butte. I wrote a whole book almost entirely because I would drive by this big open pit mine, and I noticed that there was parts of town that kind of petered off in that direction. And I was asking around and essentially found out that there used to be other neighborhoods there. But I didn't really get much more information than that. And so I think a lot of my interest just came from trying to figure out Butte, Montana, which is a fascinating mining city, which has been around a long time, right? It has this, you know, century of underground mining history long before it transitioned to open pit copper mining. And so it's a great place to study mining. And everyone there is essentially a local historian who will go on and on for hours on end to you. So it's also a really fun place to do interviews.
Are you partial to doing more like oral types of history, or do you like staying in archives and things like that?
So I like all of it. I think the best thing about oral history interviews from a historian's perspective is we often ask documents questions that they can't answer because they're written documents and they're sitting there and they're from the past. But you can ask a person the exact question that you wanted to have answered, and they'll at least take an attempt at it. And so I found that oral history interviews are a pretty helpful research method. Now, I don't use it for everything or every project, but certainly if there's a way to get a window into people's daily lives and experience, that's probably one of the best, right? They're going to be able to do a great job recounting to you exactly what they did every day for work, for instance, or what kinds of leisure activities they've done in the past. So it's a really nice window into those kinds of activities that are not going to show up in written documents. You don't normally write down everything you do at your workplace.
So did you use a lot of like these oral interviews when doing research in Butte, Montana, and specifically in your article, Protest, Power, and the Pit? I don't know if you'd like to talk about that article. Sure.
There are some interviews that I use in that particular article. Although I'd actually have to say much of that article is actually based in, you know, archives I wandered around, union archives. So a lot of the labor unions who worked in mining have materials deposited actually now around the country. They're not in Butte. This is one hard part about doing research. And so some of those things were actually kind of uncovered stories in that way. I found some strange photographs in a Life magazine article that were of kind of neighborhoods crumbling and deteriorating before our very eyes. And so that article in particular kind of came out of me trying to figure out what those images were of and why they showed up in a popular publication like Life magazine in 1950. And so I essentially eventually found both union files that suggested that unions were really upset about the introduction of open pit mining in Butte because they were going to lose numbers of employees largely because open pit mining just requires fewer employees than underground mining. But also, there are all these documents that were about some of the communities there in Butte that were protesting the expansion of the open pit mine into their neighborhoods.
So in that article, you talked a lot about the tensions between the unions and the mining companies. Are some of those tensions still around today in Butte, Montana, if you can notice them at all?
So I'd say yes and no. So there's no mining labor union there, although there is a fair amount of mining going on. The current operating mine pays fairly decent wages, which is part of it. Are there still plenty of tensions between both that company? Well, that company no longer exists, right? But essentially it was bought up by an oil company and then they shut down their mine. So really what happens is the oil company is busy cleaning up a lot of the mining refuse, doing some remediation work under guidance of the EPA. And so a lot of the tensions now are actually more about environmental cleanup in Butte than they are about the actual workplace and tensions between the company and the miners.
Do you think that that company had any original intentions when switching and transitioning to open pit mining?
Their intentions were to make money still, as you might guess. Although they were run at the Anaconda Mining Company, which was essentially the main game in town for at least a century in Butte, also was run by a lot of Butte people, even though eventually it was run from New York and had enterprises in Chile and Mexico and around the world. But they made a lot of their money in other places, but because many of those people had started in Butte, they had great affection for the community. And so actually some of that transition to open pit mining was that they wanted to save Butte and keep mining alive. And they had mined out a lot of the really good veins and figured out that they could probably just dig from the top and get a lot of the leftover copper and molybdenum and some of these other minerals they're interested in. And so I think some of it was actually them being interested in doing better, I guess, in Butte, even though it eventually had some rather detrimental effects for the community itself.
We noticed that in your article, when we talked about it, there was a lot of sort of social effects, especially with the neighborhood and with different communities and immigrant communities. Mm-hmm. So we thought that maybe there could have been something there, but that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Okay, and then in your other article we looked over today, Competition, Community, and Entertainment, the Anaconda Company's Promotion of Mine Safety in Butte, Montana, 1915 to 1942. We were just fascinated by this article, and we just wanted to know, how did you come across this?
I was trying to figure out how underground mining worked and how you made it safe. And so the Origins That article are me essentially finding this publication that the Anaconda Company had put together for a number of decades to try and promote safety to its employees. But of course, it was also trying to promote community, too, and it was using the promotion of community and fun and excitement and leisure and competitions and all these kinds of things as a way to sell safety also. And so I just became interested because I'd never read anything anywhere else about ways to promote safety other than just someone putting up a big sign, right, and saying, be safe, here's the right ways to do it, or workers' manuals, right? And so it was interesting to me that the company was trying to sell safety to its workers, especially by doing amusing things, like telling jokes about people getting injured even, you know, right? And so I think that's a really strange way to look at workplace safety.
What brought the Anaconda Company to sort of jump in on this safety first movement, as you called it?
Well, the safety first movement was a fairly complicated but increasingly big movement starting in the early 20th century across many industries. And a lot of it was had really good motivations. I mean, essentially, it was the progressive era, and a lot of people in the early 1900s thought that efficiency also meant safety, right? And so in order to be efficient, you needed to be safe. You had to keep your workforce well and healthy because sometimes it was hard to replace them, especially when it was more skilled industrial work. And so that was a lot of the impetus. And then it kind of found its way into the mining industry. And essentially, if you could explain to the industry that they would perhaps make more money if they were also keeping their workforce safe, then yeah, they would want to promote it too. Mining also is this kind of like intensely masculine industry, especially at that time, although somewhat today too. And so they also had to talk some guys into, you know, putting on helmets and, you know, being more careful with the dynamite, right? Because a lot of them were perhaps a little bit nonchalant about it, kind of on purpose, right? Because it was part of their kind of, being kings of the underground vibe, right?
So part of their promotion was they started having a lot of incentives for being like the safest crew, having like the safest record. But we noticed there tended to be a lot of negative effects with these incentives as well. Do you think the incentives ended up doing any good?
I'd say mostly yes. I think the incentives worked to some degree. I mean, certainly the workplace in Anaconda did become safer. It was essentially one of, if not the most dangerous place in America in the 19-teens, the Anaconda mines, if not even close in the world. And it was much safer by World War II. But, of course, some of that was also technological change and some other things like that, where they also started paying attention to other kinds of safe mechanisms. So did those mechanisms work? Did those little safety suggestions and competitions work? Sometimes. I mean, I think, I don't know if people were really trying to get to be the safest crew. I think some things like they would have these like first aid demonstrations in field days and have competitions like that. I think actually those might have even been more successful because since it was a public competition and you could see who won, there was actually a lot more motivation there, right, to do really well. But I think it had the effect of also helping train a lot of these first aid teams so that people were better at being first responders.
Does that sort of competition, do you think it sort of takes advantage of that masculine competition that was originally there?
Oh, I think so, yeah. They would have had a competition anyway over something because it was kind of built into a lot of the workplace culture. And so, yeah, taking advantage of that and saying instead of just having a competition over who can muck the best, which is, you know, mining terminology for shoveling, right, or who can drill the best, having a competition over who could, you know, bandage a leg and get a guy out was actually maybe not a bad idea, right? You're right, they could kind of trade on what were already kind of impulses in the workforce.
And you've sort of already touched on how there's a lot of entertainment within the safety manual. Could you go a little more into depth about that?
So some of it I won't repeat because there's a lot of ethnic and racialized language in terms of jokes and things like that. Although, you know, certainly commonplace for the day. And so some of it was just like telling jokes either very related to safety or not. They had poems. that would be in place that were often submitted by workers, right? So they'd submit a safety first poem or something like that, that they thought was important to the effort. There were lots of other kinds of ways that they use entertainment. They would sometimes have, like, there was like a women's unit that would put on special social gatherings and fun events. They also were kind of pioneers at Anaconda in using industrial films to promote safety. So they'd also like put on showings, right, in the community or in their, you know, after hours in their workplace at times when people didn't really have movies around, right? And you would actually watch this movie about, you know, mining and mining safety, which on the one hand probably would sound like the most boring thing in the world to us now. But I think if you just weren't used to films, the fact that there was filmmaking being done and that you could watch of your own workplace, I think was amazing to a lot of these people. And so I think that was also a really clever way that they used entertainment to help educate the workforce on safety.
It seems like, and especially through your article, there's this big evolution of the safety manual, especially with using new types of entertainment like film and including field days. Do you think that the pamphlet lost its original intention of safety first and just became more of like a community builder?
I think it was always being a community builder at the same time that it was promoting safety. I actually think what happened, I mean, the reason really why this manual goes away is that it actually transitions into, you're right, maybe more of a community builder, although really what happened is it petered out in World War II, and they just started producing a completely different publication by the company called the Copper Commando. And the Copper Commando was what you'd expect. It was promoting, you know, copper mining in Butte as a way to serve your country, right? And so actually this is one of the few ways you could get out of armed service, was that you could be a miner in a copper mine because they used copper for things like the bullet tips, right? When, or the, you know, on the edge on the casing. And so, you know, this is kind of a way to support the war effort. And so they kind of got away from the safety aspects and were just more interested in promoting copper mining, building the patriotic community of Butte and elsewhere around Montana through, you know, our important copper mining work. And so it kind of shifts in that way, right? I think you lose a lot of the safety focus. The safety first movement's kind of gone away. Maybe it should not have. Maybe they should have kept with some of the safety protocols. But I think some of the biggest dangers, they were having fewer things like underground fires, which had been so deadly previously.
So we've talked a lot about your work previously, your articles. Do you have any other interests besides history?
Do I have any interests besides history? I do have other interests besides history, although I tend to then turn them into history projects, which maybe is not surprising. So, you know, I guess one interest of mine, I'm really interested in gardening and urban gardening. And, you know, so I think that originally kind of started as a personal interest. And then I helped advise Augie Acres, which is the student-run organic garden on campus. And then that eventually turned into a research project looking at urban gardens. I really like, I love watching movies. My favorite thing to do is watch that Oscars ceremony. I was there tweeting about it the whole time. But, you know, that turned into eventually me doing things like, I'm now working on a research project where I'm analyzing the portrayal of mining in pop culture. So I think one of the fun things about being an academic is that you can turn things that seem like minor passions into actual work sometimes. So I can now watch fun science fiction movies and claim that I'm doing research.
The portrayal of mining in pop culture. Mm-hmm. Personally, I can't think of any. What sort of sources do you use for that? Like what pop culture mining references do you have?
Boy, you name them. So, I mean, I think some of the easiest that will immediately strike a chord are movies like Avatar, which is a, you know, the science fiction film about our blue people, the Na'vi, right, who are trying to protect their native resources. But essentially, right, it's about these big bad, I don't know who they are, Americans, world people, unclear,
capitalists,
right? Capitalists, yeah, showing up, right, to mine the native people's land. I mean, it's essentially a Western in space, right, which many science fiction movies are. And so when you look at a film like that, right, the kind of portrayal of mining, gets tied into Indeed, right? Big bad capitalists. It gets tied into some similar ideas of mining. I'd say in general, the portrayal of mining, as you might guess, is mostly negative in pop culture. Although, it actually shows up in rather interesting constructive ways. So, Minecraft, right? Popular game that lots of people play. There's other, you know, that shows up, right, where you have to get these materials to build things with them, right, depending on what mode you are in Minecraft. I mean, other video games have mining involved in them, and in fact, sometimes in ways that suggest that you can just always go back to the same spot and get more minerals, right, that they that they never disappear. So World of Warcraft even, right, has mining like that. So I think there's a bunch of things that we see commonly now, and then there's popular reality TV today. There's the Gold Rush show that's shot in Alaska that many people have seen. I think it's been one of the most popular reality shows in the last 10 years. So I think there's a lot of current examples, and there's actually fairly a large number of past ones, whether in books or movies. Westerns, as I mentioned, often have these themes as well. There's a long variety of coal mining films and coal mining songs about how tough the life is in a coal mining town. And so I think there's kind of varieties of places that you can encounter mining in pop culture.
Is your work in Butte over?
No, I don't think my work in Butte is over. I mean, I last year published a book about Butte and its encounter with open pit mining called The City That Ate Itself, a rather dramatic title. And so I think that marks at least the end of one stage of my work on Butte. But even the thing that you asked me the question about in terms of safety, that was actually an article I produced later after I was done with the book. So I continue to find fun bits and pieces of things in Butte. I also find lots of other things in other kind of mining communities, so I feel like I know Butte fairly well, so I was just doing some research in Utah, for instance, and comparing some of the things that I was seeing in Utah at the Bingham open pit mine with those things in Butte. So I think there's some nice ways where when you get really familiar with one place, you can actually learn a lot more about others too, because you have at least some of the lenses that were developed with one place that you can apply to others.
Well, thank you very much for coming out to do this interview and for talking about your passion. Lives of the Mind is an Augustana College student-run podcast project recorded in cooperation with WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. This episode was hosted by Maria Wood and myself, Charles Navarro. Theme music was written by Caitlin Tom and performed by Caitlin Tom and Douglas Ganster. Special thanks to Jared Johnson and Dr. Brian Leach for helping make this episode happen. This episode was recorded at the Doris and Victor Day Broadcast Center, home of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR, a public service of Augustana College. Thanks for listening, and as always, you can find more episodes on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to contact us anytime with comments or ideas at livesofthemind@gmail.com.